for calling, and I'll talk to you soon.
The mailbox is full and cannot accept any messages at this time. Goodbye.
Greetings, the automatically deleted husband, and the mailbox being full still remains a serious concern, but obviously, what can I do? I'm getting, you know, obviously Sunday's coming, and right now everything looks right. Looks like it's will fall in place for the trip to Big Frog, and I did send my postcard recently to George saying I want to do it with him. I want to do it with him so badly. But I did send a postcard to my wife today in reference to that. Basically, Lord willing, I'll be hiking to the top of Big Frog Mountain this Sunday with a guy roughly George's age. I'm keeping my promise to you to strive to live to be 90. I love you, I love you, I love you, you're a man, my normal clothes, because I like that lady. And, of course, when it came back from the mailbox, I had a postcard. This is the one I sent to Julia. You have again turned silent. If you ever want to reach out to your dad, my arms are open to you and your kids. I love you, Dad. So, obviously, you know, we don't want her to see this. And again, as I've stated before, what really concerns me is what's going to happen to one or more of my kids when they find out that their dad was striving as hard as I have been to reconcile. And their mom said no. That really, really concerns me because I love their mom. I love their mom. And I so desire to know how to mitigate that to whatever degree I can. One of the things I find interesting, and it concerns me because the way it relates to my kids as my kids grow up, especially my sons, even though, well, for one reason, it's not just my sons. Two more videos from Kevork Alnasian, Syriana Analysis. One is Russia's secret weapon repelling Ukraine's counteroffensive, which I thought was an interesting video because the secret weapon is drones. So there's two factors of it. The video that he embedded in to his video was a video that was just simply one after another where these relatively small Russian drones fly at, you know, they're called kamikaze drones. You know, it's showing respect to Japan because they fly into the target. It's not that they, you know, carry a bomb and they drop the bomb. No, they are the bomb. So they're just like the kamikaze planes, except the difference is it doesn't really matter that the pilot dies because the pilot is a computer. It's basically a computer and then remotely guided because it's kind of like set the target and the computer on the kamikaze drone can simply say, okay, as it moves, if it does move, I'll just, you know, follow and guide myself. So even if I lose communications, I'm there. And it's fascinating to watch the videos because, you know, a lot of them will transmit. This is my camera. I'm showing you what I'm going. And when I hit the thing, I blow up and my communications is lost, which I think is, you know, so, you know, you can watch the drone as it flies in and then explodes. But what he dropped in this video of showing one after another of these things destroying tanks, armored vehicles, and Patriot missile systems. Just one after another. And the person who did that video was pro-Ukrainian. And say, you know, this is why we got to stand with Ukraine, because look at what's happening here. And you know, and what he was doing is pointing out Ukraine is losing terribly, really badly. And, you know, one of the other aspects that was pointed out either by the embedded video or by Kevork is that these drones cost anywhere between $20,000 and $50,000. And, you know, for example, when you hit a Patriot missile system, that's multiple millions. I mean, a whole lot of millions. You hit a tank, that's a whole lot of millions. Compared to 20 to 50,000, you know, it's puts the U.S. or NATO or Ukraine at a financial disadvantage. Well, actually puts the U.S. taxpayer at the financial disadvantage. Because, I mean, what we're doing, we're not fighting a war to win. We're fighting a war to support the military-industrial complex. That's the only reason we do it. Same reason we were in Afghanistan and so forth. That is the fundamental reason. So I found that fascinating because, again, it was a video that shows the futility of what we're doing. We're losing terribly. Or, you know, the NATO is, you know. I'm not in favor of this war. So anyway, but then a second one also by Kevork. Putin exposed NATO. They stopped peace negotiations with Ukraine. And I thought it was interesting because he brought up a lot of things because I have mentioned previously the one Ukrainian negotiator at the first peace conferences. Well, the one that's referenced here. He was assassinated by the Ukrainians because, again, that was brought up. But the revelation, which you might say, is, you know, again, a whole bunch of people from Africa, various African leaders, you know, not just minions, but presidents and so forth, have formed a delegation in order to, they first went to Ukraine and said, we would like to act as an intermediary, like China has done, for example, Qatar and Saudi Arabia and others who are doing these kind of things in order to gain presence on the world stage. So this delegation from Africa went to Ukraine and had, I think it was like a 10-point peace proposal, saying, we would like to do what we can to facilitate this. And we want to be active at the table. Their reason being is because, again, what happened is Ukraine became one of the, you know, one of the breadbaskets. You know, the central part of the U.S. is called, you know, the breadbasket because that's where we grow a lot of wheat and so forth. Wheat making bread makes sense. And for a long time, the export of U.S. wheat was majority, I think, of the world consumption of wheat because... but there are other competitors on that. Two of the large competitors are Russia. It's interesting. Back in the 70s, 80s, we were exporting wheat to Russia. Now Russia exports wheat. And of course, Ukraine is a large exporter. I think they're like the third or fourth largest in the world because, you know, the environment is just right for that. So they've been doing that. And because of the war, there has been a blockade, a difficulty in getting ships out of Ukraine. So some agreements were signed in order to allow the grain exports to occur. And because one of the parties that really needed this, because they became dependent on it, was Africa, the continent in general. And the issue is the exports restarted, and the vast majority went to Europe. Which caused two problems. One, it lowered the price of what Europe produces because they were competing against relatively cheap grain from Ukraine. Plus, it didn't go to Africa. So Africa, or a small percentage went to Africa, not what was actually the reason for the removal of the blockade. It didn't show up there. So that caused some concern. And people are saying, I'm hungry, which is a really big problem. So... Africa was motivated to be a part of the peace process. It's not just simply we want to gain presence on the world stage; it's we want to eat. So, I mean, they have really serious motivation, and it seems that I read the 10 points whatnot. I didn't read the whole document, but you know, it seems reasonable because again, if you are a leader of a country. Getting your people fed seems like a rational thing to do. Otherwise, you may not remain as the leader of your country. So they did that, went to Ukraine. Ukraine said, we will not negotiate with Russia until they withdraw all troops and give us back the Donbass region and Crimea. Otherwise, no negotiation. Which is kind of like, a problem. Then the delegation went from Ukraine to Russia via Poland. And in Poland, a lot of the news crew and things of that nature that were going along, Poland said, no, you can't go. They kept him on the plane for like a day and a half. And it was not a polite thing. People with diplomatic passports apparently were strip searched, which has not gone over well. So these issues have not set NATO in good graces with the African leaders. And of course, it doesn't put NATO on the looking good on the world stage. But the top level people, the presidents and so forth, there was several presidents, several second level people from the various several African countries. They did go and have this big meeting with Vladimir Putin and Lavrov and others were there. And so you have them in this room, they're talking little things. And then Vladimir Putin does his, I'm going to make a splash here. Holds up a document. That's the image that you have here. He's holding up a document saying, back in March? Was it March of shortly after the fighting started? We had the negotiation. This is the document that was signed by the Ukrainian delegation. I mean, here it is. it was talked about, but now he made it public. He said, that we had no confidentiality agreement on this. We haven't talked about it. Here it is. So now we're talking about it. So the issue is, he set forth, this is the document we signed. Here are the signatures and so forth. And because one of the things that, because what they, if you recall, one of the things that occurred is that when the events started, obviously they went into the Donbass, because that was the fundamental area. They wanted to protect the Donbass because that is the predominant Russian population. And as it's now described, that is now part of Russia. So they went to the Donbass, and they also went to Kiev in order to say, this is an act of war here. So we're making our presence known. And we want to demilitarize you and the various other things, denazify and all those kind of things that they had talked about. And so what they did is they went and did mostly surround the city, but not really enter it that much. I think they had some things enter, but very little. And then apparently, because I know they later withdrew, and I think part of it was because of this agreement that was signed. But part of it was too, because you've got the Ukrainian military now focused on protecting Kiev. So the other stuff they were doing, they had too many fronts, and they overwhelmed the Ukrainian military. So because the objective, at least at that point, was not to take over Ukraine, but by putting their forces around Kiev, it seriously distracted the Ukrainian forces. So it was strategic in both ways, and of course, because there was both no intent apparently, plus it did help on the negotiation process, and they had this document saying, yes, we're going to negotiate with you. And of course, what happened was, as it's described, the Ukraine just simply ignored it, threw it in the trash. And so they made the agreement. They ignored the agreement. The negotiator was assassinated by Ukraine. They killed their own people, which they do a lot of. And so now this more of this stuff came to the table. So the issue is, one of the things I wonder is, there's this tension, and it's artificial. It's inflated by the way the news media covers it and so forth. And it's really unfortunate, because there's people dying on both sides that it's completely unnecessary. And both sides are being instilled a hatred for the other side that really is not based on reality. It's based on the fictitious stories a fictitious tension, a tension that's unnecessary. And what this leads to is, you know, several things. Well, you know, one is, one of the things I thought about is the Great Wall of China many, many, many years ago. When that was built, that was a massive defensive system. And so, I mean, it was, it made China very, you know, the China of the day protected it extremely well from invasion because it was a real strong barrier. But it didn't work because I think it was at least twice. It may have been three times, but I think at least twice. The barrier was penetrated. How? You bought off people and whatnot in order to go through the wall and things of that nature, you know, in various places. So through corruption and whatnot, it didn't work. So you had this massive structure and it didn't work. In the same way, you look at, for example, the Patriot missile system. You have this massive, expensive system designed to protect, and it's not. Because, and I do think, because one of the things, because, you know, again, this is, it comes back to the, I need to add that too. There's a group that is trying to prevent the growth of autonomous weapons, and they did an interesting video. I need to put that one on too, a long time ago, because what's happened. You know, as I've expressed before, I would contend if you look throughout history from a long time ago, first you had, I'm the big dude, the Goliath. Don't mess with me because I'm going to crush you because, I mean, he's too strong. Then you come to, you develop an entourage around you. So it's no longer the big dude, but the entourage, the military. And you have the figurehead, and all he has to do is have authority over his group, and then the group has the authority over the entourage because you now have to deal with his military. And it's the collective thing. And if somebody within that collective says, no, I don't want to be part of this, he's in trouble because the rest of the collective says, no, I'm with the collective. I don't want to die, basically. And then, of course, we move to, you know, in order to maintain that, you had to have, why would this person be our king? Well, then we have things like the divine right of kings. And then, of course, we migrated to democracy to give us the illusion that it's our choice. So we have a person who's in charge because we made the choice. But again, that's, you know, it's the Lord says directly in the Deuteronomy 17, it's his choice, not ours. And there's all that other thing. But so in the same way, when you look at the way that those things have changed, I would suggest the same thing has transpired with weapons. You know, obviously first it was, I'm going to hit you, you know, because I'm a big strong guy. Then I have the swords. Then I have the slings and so forth. You know, the sword, I'm, you know, face to face. The sling, I can go to a distance. Guns, cannons, and so forth. And then airplanes and whatnot continues that process. And, you know, it's kind of like, well, it's the discussion of the nuclear weapons. We did the Hiroshima and Nagasaki because we made a big bang. But the nuclear weapons have continued in like Fallujah and so forth that I've mentioned, where it's not the big bang, but it's the individual bullets that because of the fact that it leaves the radiation on the ground in wherever the community is, you're killing the next generation. Through you know, because of the radiation that is left there, and so people are dying of cancer and birth defects and so forth. So it's kind of, instead of the big bang, you have the bunch of little ones. In the same way, we have these big missiles. We have the big planes. We have the big missiles and so forth. And now the defense against them and the big tanks. You know, these massive tanks with all this. Expensive gear and so forth on them, and you have this relatively cheap drone that attacks it and destroys it. Because one of the issues you have is, you know, if you're in a tank has all, you know, one of the purposes behind a tank is it has that really thick metal all around you. So if you fire a bullet at it, it's kind of like, so what? you have to fire a, you know, a fairly large, you know, even, you know, 50 caliber guns. So what? And if you fire a modest bomb, you know, a type missile, you may have an impact. You need something fairly serious because you got to penetrate the armor. You don't need that much to do that. You just need the right kind of explosives to penetrate the armor, but you got to get to it. And you know, a tank doesn't have the defensive systems like a Patriot system and so forth. At least they don't today. So when a drone is casually flying at a fairly modest speed towards it, it's kind of like, what do? I can't like turn my turret to you know, or I don't have another gun to. That's not in the system today. So these drones that are relatively cheap, you know, again, I think they're like $5-10 million tanks are taken out by a $20,000 drone. And so both the economics of it and the fact that this drone has nobody on it, and you have a crew of maybe 3 to 6 people in the tank, and they're all dead. So it's a losing battle. And then, one of the things that was fascinating, the complete failure video, apparently, because you can see the drones coming, apparently a lot of times people see, okay, we are around a tank, an armored vehicle, a Patriot missile system or whatnot. There's a drone coming. There's nothing we can do. The only thing we can do personally, run. And one of the things they pointed out, a whole lot of people, they're at this place. Here comes the drone. They run. The equipment is destroyed and the people survive, which I think is fascinating. I mean, that's fascinating. But see, the issue is, this is the way war is changing. And then the next step is group about the autonomous drones and so forth. You know, these drones are modest size, you know, like a small plane or smaller. But a lot of them now are the things, the size that you can buy for, you know, consumer. And a lot of times what people are doing is they're buying the consumer drones and attaching either, you know, and attaching a bomb to it. And so it's a cheap way in order to deliver a payload. And either you drop it, you know, because you fly over something and you just drop a modest payload to drop a, you know, bomb or something of that nature, or chemicals or whatever, or you fly it in like the kamikaze drone. But so that's become really cheap. But there's work being done on one step further. And that is the idea of really tiny drones. You know, the kind of thing that you can hold in your hand or smaller. And the objective behind those is, just like the drone going to a tank, you don't need a lot of explosive power because you're so close. You just get to the right spot. And you need enough power just to penetrate the vulnerable spot of the drone, of the tank. So the amount of explosive charge you need is fairly small. Another thing you could do is, if all you needed to do, if you could get your drone to, for example, to the back of somebody's head, you know, a tiny little, you know, palm-sized drone, and you get to the back of somebody's head because they're not going to get that way, you know, get to that. And it has basically a bullet on it. That's all it needs. So you get close to the person. You have one bullet. You don't need anything fancy. You fire that bullet. You kill the person. So with a relatively cheap drone, you're not causing massive destruction, but you're killing people. And if you make those things cheap, one of the examples they do is show is, You fly over a city and you just drop these en masse. And because you have put a good bit of computing power on that, a drone could say, okay, there's a person, you know, with, you know, fairly modest stuff that you have in your cell phone that identifies faces, for example. Oh, there's a person there and I'm going for him. So if that person runs and whatnot, I'm not going to destroy the community. I'm not going to destroy vehicles or things of that nature. I'm going after that person to kill him. That's warfare in the coming years. And I really think we will see that in some way. Probably not in the Ukraine war, because I do think this is suddenly going to come to an end. But in the next one, we probably will see something like that. Either by a country's military, U.S., Russia, China, whatnot, or by a what we would generally call a terrorist group, because they could go into a city and kill lots of people. These are the things that I think are going to transpire. So what do you do about it? The Great Wall of China didn't work. Patriot systems are being destroyed constantly and so forth. So, yeah, we're making money in war, but we're going to lose the war. And, you know, again, the U.S. is really losing it on the world stage. So what do we do? One of the things that concerns me is what I'm sensing from when I talk with people about, you know, it's Russia's bad, China's bad, we're good. You know, the same thing that you had during Vietnam, during Iraq, during World War II and whatnot. They're bad, we're good. And so we do our patriotic duty and join the military. The military that, well, like my dad went into, was very different than, well, the, you know, I say I went in the Air Force, not the military, but it was very much early in a transition, and the transition has very much happened now. And again, because I've said before, I went in as escape, and I was wrong, but even more so today. So I'll remind you of, and I'll give you the it's called Emma, the calling, go Army. And this is what the Army has turned into. You know, here is this woman, I had two mommies kind of thing, and I protest. I'm a frail woman, and it's kind of like, I'm sorry, you're not a soldier in the sense of the guy with the sword. Who's big and strong, he's going to come to hurt you. This has changed. We're not that way anymore. We're going to come and give you a pride flag. And that's why, and I didn't find him, but, you know, when that video came out, there was the video from the Russian and from the Chinese army, and they're recruiting men. We're recruiting wimps. And, you know, and of course, there's the mass of the homosexuality thing and whatnot is just rampant in the military. So the idea that we're going to win a war? Now, both the battlefield has changed because of drones and so forth, and the soldiers have changed. So the bottom line on this is, as an act of love, I want to encourage my kids. I made the mistake of going in. Went in for 5 years. I had the joy of being able to travel Europe and so forth, but I never fired a gun. Well, except, well, the, you know, the basic training I did. But otherwise, I never fired a gun, never carried a gun, nothing of that nature. Nuclear weapons, yes, but, you know, otherwise, no, saw nothing of that. But others do. And again, what is the leading killer of people in the military now? Suicide, because of what they do to others. So I'm the whole point of all this is, you see, we're losing on the world stage in so many ways, and there's that call to go in, be patriotic. No, I'm sorry, it's be suicidal. Don't go in. I want to instill into my kids, especially my sons, and even more so my daughters, don't look at the military. It's also, you know, because it's closer to what I do. I looked at some stuff when the CIA was doing recruitment videos at the same time. Fundamental objective: we're politically correct. We look at you about your ethnicity, you know, your skin color, your language, and whether or not you're homosexual. Those are the things that qualify you to be, to excel in the CIA. And I would suggest the NSA, which is even closer to what I do, is exactly the same way. And that's why we're going to collapse from within. Because we don't have an objective anymore. The military industrial complex, whatnot, is there to make money, and the people within the system are there for the pride of it, the good salary, and so forth. But have no idea what they're doing. not at all. So I wanted to express that. And while I was having breakfast, I saw something that was the opposite. So I'm going to include that too. Oasis of Peace, which I thought was a fascinating story because, as I've mentioned, especially the woman, Maria something, I think of that nature, who's done this. She's done a lot of, she's doing a lot of things in the country of Israel that have been a little bit provocative. And I would suggest this one is. What she did, she went to a community, I think was started like in the 1970s, bunch of Jewish people and Jewish people and Arab people said, this tension is wrong. Let's form a community and live together in peace. They formed this community. It's been thriving apparently now for a whole lot of years, decades. They attempted to expand because there's interest in it. And the Israeli government said no. They said no, you can't expand that area. Because that's not what they want. Jews and Arabs living peacefully together? No, we can't have that. I would suggest it's exactly what we need. You know, again, one of the things I see, and I even see it from Kvork, because I see it a lot of people. I see a whole lot in the Islamic community. I've seen it. You know, it's the idea of we want vengeance or never forgive. That's what I've seen from a couple of Kvork's videos. Never forgive. If you're a follower of Christ, you forgive. Those people over there came to me, to my land, to my country, you know, my part of the country, whatnot. They killed my family, destroyed my home, did all sorts of vile things. You forgive. That's why I have on my wall here, that's the photo I need to use. A man in the Donbass region, interviewed by an RT reporter. Will you ever be able to forgive them? And his response is, God will forgive them. And what I saw in that, what I sensed in that, because of the pause of the guy after being asked, is I don't want to, but in obedience to Christ, I know I must. Somebody does something extremely vile, destroys your home, kills people in your family. And the Lord says, forgive them. The Lord and the Lord alone is the one who does vengeance. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. Those lines, that word, that phrase, that line, idea has to sink in. Vengeance is the job of the Lord, not of man. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. You know how hard that is? You know, that man on the wall here, you know how hard it was for him to say that? I do. And that's the issue. The reason I can talk about this is because I understand it. Because I know how to take vengeance. I have a lot of ways I can take vengeance on a lot of people. But I'm trying to bless Jim Cross, Render Keynes, Chris Bitterman. I'm trying to bless my kids. Most of them have no part of this, and I'm trying to bless my wife, even if I never see her again. I'm trying to bless all those who are involved in being less of kind in the destruction of my family. Bless those who persecute you. It is not easy. It is not easy. What you see, I would suggest, the great analogy maybe is what you saw. If you look at the video, again, Kevork, who will basically tell you, you know, what the Ukrainian government is doing is really bad. And what NATO is doing is really bad. And he has a personal thing involved here because NATO attacked his homeland, Syria. So, you know, there's that tension. And that's why I think there's the never forgive idea from him. However, what you see in the video done by the pro-Ukrainian group that he shows is you see, as I pointed out, the kamikaze drone coming towards tanks, armored vehicles, radar units, or the Patriot systems and whatnot. People see it, and they say, the equipment is destroyed. Nobody was injured. And I think that's a great model. And that's a model that I would like to follow. I want to destroy the equipment that is damaging my family and others, but make sure the people survive. The process of reconciliation, the whole point of the Shofar Leaks project, the seeking reconciliation, is I don't want to destroy the people, but in some cases, open the door of reconciliation so that people survive. I would suggest similar mentality. That's what I'm striving for. I'm striving for this because you may have heard me say this before, because I'm a follower of the Lord Jesus Christ. He commands me to love. If I can do this, and it doesn't help me at all, it doesn't help my family, anybody, but the ecosystem's in place and it helps somebody else, I've succeeded. If I strive to do this, and for whatever reason I fail, I go to the top of Big Frog Mountain Sunday, I get there, I get to do my jumping jacks, and here comes an Apache helicopter and wipes me out. Oh well, I don't succeed, but I've tried. It's just like the fact that I'm trying to get to the top of Big Frog Sunday. If I don't make it for one reason or another, the big thing I have, even if we don't take the first step, is I've tried. I think that's, you know, it's somebody says, it's similar to the idea of, you know, a big journey, whatever, takes the first step. But there's so many times a particular venture doesn't happen because you don't take that first step. I want to encourage my kids, don't look at the military, because all that is you're becoming cannon fodder. Strive to find ways in your life that you are simply someone who blesses, not someone who is, well, cannon fodder or used as a tool. Don't be a minion. Be someone who loves. I want to get that to my kids. Walter and Zadok, my two young guys, the two that my sons, your focus in life is not to gain power, but to bless. Please, your focus in life, not to gain power, but to bless. Because you're a creation of our Lord. You're not a lord over somebody else. I want to get to live in an oasis of peace. Go to those people who the world says, you know, they're bad, we're good, you're bad, and befriend them. Become an ally to them. Love them. Love your enemies. Another short video. My family, I want to set before you a model of someone who is striving to bless, not curse, to do good to his enemies, and to seek reconciliation. My lady, my wife, I love you and I want you back.